which pledged allegiance to the Islamic State last year. Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International had urged for a stay of execution, claiming that three of the convicted men were already in custody months before the attacks took place. The hanging comes a day after former President Mohamed Morsi was sentenced to death by an Egyptian court. Myanmar has refused to shoulder the blame for an escalating crisis involving thousands of persecuted Rohingya Muslims stranded at sea. Boats filled with more than 2,000 desperate and hungry people have landed in Indonesia, Malaysia, and Thailand, and thousands more migrants are believed to be adrift at sea after a crackdown on human traffickers prompted captains and smugglers to abandon their human cargo. All three countries have dispatched their navies to push boats away or execute a so-called help-on policy of giving the boats food and water and pointing them to other countries. German naval ships have orders to rescue refugees in the Mediterranean and then sink their boats, according to a report published in Bild am Sonntag. The German mass circulation newspaper claims that the ships Hessen and Berlin have sunk five boats since May 5th.
And hello. If you've just joined us, please stay tuned for our regularly scheduled program of Indigenous Talk Radio with the Angry Indian on Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
Listening to Angry Indian Radio, the podcast of the Aboriginal Press News Service.
Find us on the web, ang-newswire.blogspot.com.
This is APNS Public Radio.
The opinions expressed in dispatches represent the analysis of the participating editors and may not necessarily reflect the group positions of the ANG or its public news wires.
I think Angry Indian is one of those people who likes to walk up to two guys and say, let's see you and him fight.
Internet radio for smarter.
All right, this is Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. Welcome back. A lot of people are not, you know, really cognizant about Indigenous politics to begin with. And when it comes to Indigenous politics in Mexico, it's always a question, because in Mexico, most people do not want to even acknowledge that Indigenous people exist. Indigenous people in the major cities are called Marias. And other epithets, you know, they're simply not respected. Other Indian people who consider themselves to be cosmopolitan, what have you, who are of Indian descent, who are of Indian blood, you can look at them. If you mention the Zapatistas, if you mention Oaxaca, if you mention even the Yaqui, there's a real ugly consternation, you know, a cultural and class consternation that comes down, which pretty much validates everything that the Zapatistas have been about. Now, for those of you who remember the day that the that NAFTA took in, you know, when Bill Clinton was in office, you know, we remember the crash that happened in Mexico. You know, the peso was worth almost nothing for quite a bit. And it was really, really hard on the populace. And the Zapatistas realized that there was a tie-in to this. On what was happening to them in terms of the militarization, in terms of the drug cartels that they were in battle with on a regular basis, because they steal men to work for them in the fields, and they take the women for work and for other things. And, you know, the Mexican army it is corrupt, like most of the government there, the entire political system, you know, in most of the nation south of the border, and I'm including Texas. All right. They're corrupt, and they've been corrupt for centuries. So they work with the cartels for kickbacks. They work with the American firms that want to take the land down there in Oaxaca. So when they declared, you know, their war, their resistance against the Mexican government, it wasn't to take over the Mexican government. It was to be free in Chiapas. to be free in Oaxaca, to be free where their people are. And, you know, we're not talking about the Zapatistas anymore. And for those who are cognizant, we're aware that Subcomandante Marcos has stepped down, that there is a new leader, even though the media still focuses on him, and that's one of the reasons why he has stepped back. You know, we're really not discussing the Zapatistas anymore, and I find that to be shameful. You know, being that the struggle at the Zapatistas, the timing of it, the rhetorical elegance of the communiques. I have not read a communique from the Zapatistas that was not politically accurate. Not one. Not one. And, you know, call it propaganda, call it what you want. They're telling the truth, and they're doing it in an effective way, but we're not listening. Now, I want to bring in Scott Campbell. On Twitter, he's, you know, otherwise known as the Angry White Kid, and I really enjoy his posts. I enjoy following him because he goes into these areas. And, you know, as always, you know, he identifies himself as an angry white kid. You know, that's, you know, so... You know, it needs to be acknowledged when it's out there. You know, we talk about white racism. We talk about white supremacy. We talk about colonialism all the time. But we don't talk about the, you know, Caucasians that fight against it, that stand by us, that are part of our struggles. And I think that's important to acknowledge because, you know, many of them, like Scott Campbell, who are doing the work, are not out here waving flags saying, look at me, I'm a white guy and I'm out here helping you. They're not doing that. They're doing the work. And, you know, his blog is one of the few that still carries these Zapatista communiques because that's recently how I've been getting them. You know, I mean, we do carry the acknowledgement, you know, about their radio program. Sometimes it's on, sometimes it isn't. You know, we still do the PSA for that. But media-wise, they've been having a hell of a hard time trying to get their message out. And obviously, you know, not too many new services are dealing with this, except for perhaps the anarchist press and the if you want to say the hard left, if we want to go there. But, you know, for the most part, you know, this blogger is one of the few online activists that has been dealing with this issue. And I'd like to bring him in right now. Scott, welcome to Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
Hi there. Thank you so much for having me on. It's a pleasure to be here.
Okay, so, you know, the Zapatistas, why don't you break it down for our listeners on who the Zapatistas are, what exactly it is that they're about, and why it's been so difficult for many on the political left to identify with this movement, for the most part, you know, or primarily because they refuse to identify.
Precisely. The Zapatistas are an indigenous guerrilla army / social movement / communities and resistance in the southeastern state of Chiapas in Mexico. And they began organizing 31 years ago, and then they launched onto the scene on January 1st, 1994, 21 years ago, with an armed uprising taking over two-thirds of the state of Chiapas, specifically designed to coincide with the beginning of the North American Free Trade Agreement, which you mentioned in the introduction. And they fought the Mexican army for 12 days before people who read their demands and heard their first initial declaration of war and the 10 demands they listed in their food, justice, housing, freedom. People throughout the world and in particular in Mexico who resonated with it took to the streets in support of their demands. And in a way, this manifestation of support led to the Mexican army deciding to enter into negotiations with the Zapatistas. On the other hand, the Zapatistas did take the army completely by surprise, and if these people didn't show up into the streets, who knows what would have eventually happened. And they make that clear in one of the communiques they recently published, that they feel sometimes the street gets too much credit for their success initially. But since then, they've been not only fending off attacks from the Mexican army, from paramilitaries linked and funded by the Mexican government, from cartels, from international interests who consider Zapatistas a stain on the profitability of Mexico as a place to extract resources. They've been building autonomy for 21 years. They've been running the areas under their control by people who proclaim themselves to be Zapatistas. Right now, they're referred to as Zapatista support bases. and they craft their own way of living based on indigenous customs, based on ancestral knowledge, and also based on the analysis of their 21st century situation that they're living in, and what are the best ways to meet their needs, their demands, in an egalitarian, autonomous, non-hierarchical fashion. They've been doing this, you know, with much applause and without much applause for 21 years. And as, especially in the North, and especially on, even on the left, our memory is short. We lack a broad historical framework. And so 21 years, someone doing something for 21 years, we sort of, at least I know I can lose sight of that. I can lose sight of the fact that if they're not making headlines, if they're not doing big glamorous actions, but instead doing the real daily work of making a revolution on the ground for their communities, people decide it's not so sexy anymore, it's not worth paying attention to, and it falls from the headlines, even the headlines on the left. But they've been doing this work, and they've been trying to come up with various ways of engaging the left, both in Mexico and internationally. They held in 1995 a consensus on their goals, and they basically leafleted all of Mexico and had people fill out ballots to vote on the San Andres Accords, which they negotiated with the government. Then they held a march on Mexico City in early 2000 or 2001 with 1,111 delegates, where they spoke. Comandanta Ramona gave an address wearing her ski mask to the Mexican Congress. Then they launched the sixth international, the sixth communique from the Selva Lacandona, which they tried to get all the groups who were opposed to capitalism and who were dedicated to anti-authoritarian organizing to begin to talk to each other to try and foment this resistance. And instead of focusing on one thing here and one thing there, to broaden the scope of the vision so that all struggles found a commonality and a way to support one another, and that an injury to one, it truly is an injury to all. And most recently, just at the beginning of this month in May, they held a seminar / seedbed, as they called it, in San Cristobal de las Casas in Chiapas, in their Caracol of Oventic, one of their support bases, of critical thinking and the capitalist hydra, in which they proposed that capitalism in its current manifestation is finding new ways of entering into society, entering into our consciousnesses, entering into our ways of life that mean the old resistances against capitalism don't really work as well anymore. And so they're proposing that we need to analyze how capitalism is now manifesting in order to understand how we can best resist it. And this is what is difficult to pin down about the Zapatistas, is they don't fall into any traditional definition of left wing. You can't call them communists, you can't call them socialist or anarchist. They are their own manifestation. And they formed when Marxist professors and organizers from Mexico City went down into Chiapas thinking they were going to recruit an army of indigenous people, and they found that the indigenous people wanted nothing to do with them, until they started listening and found that the indigenous people knew very well for themselves what they wanted and what they needed, and that what the folks from Mexico City could offer was practical support. And that, from the very basis of that, formed this Zapatista identity, which is known as Zapatismo because there's no other way to define it. And that's, you know, anarchists have tried to claim it, communists have tried to claim it, but they refuse those labels. They appreciate the contributions made by these theories, but they make it very much their own because they're very much living in their own reclaimed territory, reclaimed space, and reclaimed autonomy.
Yeah, now I recognize this as an indigenous movement, which in South America is known as indigenismo. Could you break that down for folks who are used to things being split through Eurocentric lines in terms of the political left and the political right, a leftover really from the French Revolution? You know, where does indigenismo fit into this? You know, or does it not fit in to this to that dichotomy at all? Because it's neither right nor left. like you said, they're dealing with the fourth world, so they're within their own political sphere, you know, independent socially, culturally, and attempting to be economically and politically separate. So, you know, how does that fit in for those coming from the United States and Canada, and even within Mexico, who really do not understand politics? And when they see these communiques, or when they hear about them, they really don't know where to put the Zapatistas and other movements that are like that in their own consciousness. You know, how they're able to actually work it out within their heads.
That's a fantastic question, and it's one that it's difficult to conceptualize when we live in a world, say here in the U.S., of political parties, and it's Republican, Democrat elections, and even most of us who are in opposition to that find ourselves having to define our politics based on a political spectrum from left to right. And what the Zapatistas and other indigenous groups throughout Latin America, and including, I would argue, in North America as well, that they're saying, yes, that's fine, but really what we have goes back far beyond, you know, far before you came up with your ideas of political parties and tried to impose them on us here. What they're doing is they're saying the place where we live, where we're organizing, that we call our homes, has been part of us, our life, for thousands of years, and the Mexican state just happened to be imposed on top of us. And with the Mexican state came capitalism, came political parties, and came ways to divide people, new ways to divide people and pit them against each other, and to classify and discriminate and so on and so forth. And they're saying what we want is, one of their first earliest statements was, what we want is a place in this flag, when they would hold up the Mexican flag, because they still have the Mexican flag at all their events. And they say, we're not trying to take over power. They say everything for everyone and nothing for ourselves. What they want is to basically be left alone, to be allowed to determine their own destinies separate from the Mexican state. They see what the Mexican state offers. They say, no, we have a better way, and we're going to defend that right and defend our way of life. And determine for ourselves what our lives are going to look like. Therefore, full autonomy, full self-determination, full autogestion. And you can see that playing out in Oaxaca, in South America, in Central America, where indigenous groups are seeing what capitalism and what the nation state has to offer, and its destruction and poverty and racism, and they want no part of it. And they have traditional ways of organizing that can be modified to meet the conditions of the 21st century, and that's what they're proposing.
Native Americans in the lower 48, politically speaking, when it comes to other indigenous groups, you know, just as powerless, but, you know, there's an illusion that because there's a handful of representatives, if you want to call them representatives, in the Bureau of Indian Affairs, you know, in various, you know, scattered seats within the federal government, matters that deal with the interior and what have you. And then we look at other nations in Africa, in Indonesia. We see the people of Papua New Guinea standing up. They are politically organized. They have a government in exile. We see the Rohingya. They have a government in exile. They're facing, you know, terrible, terrible prejudice from Buddhists in what used Burma / Myanmar. And we see that the number one activist from that country has not even spoken up in their defense. And, you know, are Native Americans in the United States asleep? That's what I'm asking. We hear a lot of talk in the mainstream press about casinos, and every now and again we'll see a feature story in, like, say, Time magazine on how the money does not go to the actual people. I'm not negating any of these things, but my point is, we think that by working within the system, by getting people who are native in certain positions, that somehow that this is going to make change. And then we look at, say, the Zapatistas. We look at the resistance movement in the Hawaiian Islands. We look at the Chamorro resistance in Guam. We look at the resistance that our brothers and sisters, the First Nations, are doing in Canada. They stop entire railroads. They block off roads. They stop shipping to the point now where every Native American, you know, every Indian, every First Nations person within the legal confines of Canada, according to their intelligence service, is regarded as a potential terrorist. What is going on or not going on in the United States? When we look south at the Zapatistas, when we look north at the Atchin, and I'm not going as far as to talk about the Oka crisis, but that's close enough. We have women that are missing on both borders, north and south. What is going on in the United States? Or really, let me frame this. What is going on in Mexico and further south and in Canada that is not happening in the United States?
That's a good question, and I, to be honest, I don't know much about indigenous organizing and the status of it in the United States. What I can attest to is that I feel that in the South, we see Mexico and further on down south in Latin America, we see the direct impact of capitalism, where people are losing, where land privatization, poverty, that sort of thing is forcing migration internally in Mexico and to north to the U.S. and elsewhere. And in Canada, we can see how resource extraction is already in full effect and the devastation is already underway in order to bring the resources down into the United States. So we see, again, like the U.S. as the metropole extracting from the north and the south, and perhaps that may be a reason why we see these resistances coming up sooner. I would also... just on, maybe it's conjecture, but the severe oppression that the indigenous movement saw in the 50s, 60s, and 70s with the repression of the American Indian movement and so on, that really brought such devastation against the organizing base that I feel a lot of it hasn't been recovered, and they're concerned with getting their needs met via means such as casinos, and the idea that they tried to go against the system and the system came down very hard, very severely, very ruthlessly, and the legacies like Leonard Peltier and so on were still in jail and still suffering, and the devastation that is still going on, and the severe endemic poverty and displacement and resource extraction and pollution and every blight that capitalism can bring upon a people has been brought upon the indigenous people of the United States. And I don't know why we're not hearing more. I believe there is a lot of resistance happening, but it's perhaps not getting the attention it deserves, because perhaps it's not as easily accessible due to its location, and it's not perhaps as integrated on social media and so on as some other efforts are. That's what I have to say on the topic, but I would encourage people to consult other sources than myself, because I don't know too much about it.
Well, yeah, but I asked you because I want to make the connection, because there is a connection. Now, you've mentioned, you know, resistance, and you're right. There's quite a bit of resistance. Not that everybody agrees, not that everyone gets along with each other necessarily, right? But, you know, there is resistance. Now, in Canada, or Canada proper, you have the I Don't Know More movement, which, depending on who you ask as an observer, it's either up or it's down, and it kind of goes in waves. But, you know, maybe it, in some ways it got reduced, because it certainly didn't start out this way, but it got reduced to being a bit of a hashtag in terms of how people conceptualize it mentally. But the resistance in Canada is so severe, in terms of the First Nations, in their resistance to what Canada, especially under Stephen Harper, is trying to do. You know, and what he's already done and what he's not doing, but now what he's really trying to do, where they basically passed a rule not too long ago that criminalizes all Native descent as an act against the state. Because, you know, you're stopping, you know, commerce or what have you by, you know, blocking the trains and blocking commerce. That they're like, well, hell, you know, this is a form of terrorism now. Now, as far what I'm trying to get to is, Canada looks at the resistance from natives because they see this resistance as being that much. You know, we're not even talking about whether it's right or wrong in terms of, you know, whether or not indigenous people have a right to argue. They have a natural right to argue. And under international law, they have a right to argue and demand their rights. And they're acting peaceably. You know, they're not hurting anyone. You know, officers are not being harmed, but they're putting people in the hospital. They're waving guns in the faces of Native people up there. And like I said, we have women who are missing in the thousands on the Canadian-American border and in the thousands on the Mexican-American border. And, you know, and I'm not dismissing the Native movement in the United States, but if it was acting as they as you know, the movements are acting in Canada or in Indonesia or in, even in South Africa under the ANC, in Mexico, in Chile, in Guatemala, they are so active. Everybody comes out. Everybody supports these things, and they're on the same page. And, you know, I'm still, you know, asking, not that you're an expert on this, but the Zapatistas were part of the, you know, because they used the internet. They were the first indigenous group to really, really use the internet. And that spread their message all the way to the Netherlands, all throughout Africa, anyone who had a, you know, a computer and an internet connection. So I ask again, you have educated people who are right here in the United States, not just indigenous folks. And there are, you know, educated indigenous people who do try to do things, but they're individuals. They, you know, they don't, there is no structure for this. And even though you mentioned the political weight in terms of the American Indian movement and what have you, and all of that is true, you know, the average American in the United States knows full well that North America was colonized by force. So why is it that the average person does not give a damn about what's happening to the Native American when we see what's happening with the Zapatistas and when we see what's happening with the First Nations in Canada?
I think that's a great question. I feel that what happens is there's that awareness, and what it produces is guilt, because it's a guilt that would force a reckoning with the past. And with that past comes not only the genocide against the indigenous peoples, but slavery, you know, sexism. I mean, all of the institutional isms that had to occur in order for the United States to become what it is today. And I don't feel that most people in the United States personally or collectively have the tools to process the historical legacy of the United States, nor is there a willingness on the side of the leadership and the media and the creators of culture and the creators of societal norms to engage in that whatsoever. I also feel that in the United States, capitalism, I'm going back to the Zapatistas and the analysis that they're proposing, capitalism is so refined that it's very, very good at isolating and individualizing both people and communities. So we can say one indigenous community here in Arizona is dealing with an issue, but instead of finding common cause with the plight of indigenous people throughout the Americas, they take it upon them. Capitalism is able to say, buy them off with a casino and tell them that that'll solve their problems. As we know, no solution offered by capitalism will solve the problems created by capitalism, because the consistent thing is the extraction of profit above all else. And I think we're in this middle phase where the direct confrontation didn't work. It was put down. Now there's the era of trying to extract concessions from the government. And then once people see that that stops working, I think there's going to be a new manifestation of resistance, which is what the Zapatistas are trying to articulate.
We're going to take a break. We're going to, you know, broaden this conversation a little bit, because like as I mentioned a little bit ago, the Zapatistas went to the internet and they saw the potential in terms of, you know, making their stand against the Mexican government understood by the world population. You know, they really internationalized the indigenous movement. And that's where I learned the term fourth world. That's how I came into contact with that. And I realized that it didn't, you know, end with the American Indian movement, that this was an ongoing, continuous struggle. And it was at that point that I really realized that I can make a difference with the internet as well. So we're speaking to Scott Campbell, otherwise known as the Angry White Kid on Twitter. You can check out his personal website at angrywhitekid.blogs.com. He is an anarchist, a translator, and a blogger. And he is an anti-colonialist activist and one of the few social justice activists within the United States that still produces and promotes the communiques from the Zapatista National Army. This is Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. Please stay tuned.
Don't let the colonial occupation blues get you down. Listen to the Angry Indian on Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. The podcast for Intelligent Aboriginal.
Radio Insurgente, la voz de los sin voz.
Vamos, 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 vamos adelante, para que salgamos en la lucha avante, porque nuestra patria grita y necesita de todo el esfuerzo de los zapatistas.
Transmitiendo desde algún lugar de las montañas del sureste mexicano, en la frecuencia 97.9 en FM.
Hey everybody, it's Dr. Vibe, the host and producer of the Dr. Vibe Show at thedrvibeshow.com. At our show, we do conversations and provide information for black men and those who love them. So come check us out. Also at iTunes, and also selective episodes are featured at the Good Men Project, one of the most viewed websites in the world for men. So find out about black men and those who love them at the Dr. Vibe Show.
Hi, this is Tom Hartman. What country comes to mind when you hear the following? Protesters confined to fenced-in so-called free speech zones. The government illegally spying on citizens and producing phony news reports. People imprisoned without charge or access to a lawyer. Prisoners tortured and killed. And an illegal war launched on the basis of lies in which illegal weapons are used against civilians, journalists, and hospitals. We like to think of countries other than our own when we think of such crimes being committed. But the responsibility to call a halt to such abuses of power always lies with the citizens of the government involved. In this case, that is to say, with us, whether we like it or not. The United States Constitution contains a remedy for such abuses so central to our system of checks and balances that it appears in that document six times. That remedy? Impeachment. Our duty is to demand it from our members of Congress. This message is sponsored by AfterDowningStreet.org.
Free Leonard. It is mind-blowing for us to be here, now, at this late hour, with Leonard Peltier still in chains. Books have been written, documentaries have been produced, congressmen have joined his freedom campaign, all for naught. For Leonard Peltier, a former leader of the American Indian Movement, AIM, is still not free. That, to anyone with a soul, is a damn shame. Many Peltier supporters put their trust in a politician named Bill Clinton, who told them that when he got elected, he wouldn't forget about the Native American leader. Their trust, like those of so many others, was betrayed once Clinton gained the office and the FBI protested. In the waning days of his presidency, he issued pardons to folks like Mark Rich and other wealthy campaign contributors. Leonard Peltier was left in his chains. I won't restate the obvious. Leonard's innocence, the blatantly unfair trial, the crooked tricks that led to his extradition. Others may do that. What is needed is more support, not from two-faced politicians, but from the people, the many, who, like me and you, no injustice when we see it. Join the movement to free Leonard Gwath-Elas, or he who leads the people. Build it, for only a mass movement can bring freedom. Thank you. On the move, long live John Africa. From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu Jamal.
Coming to you live from Northeast Jefferson County, Kansas. Your one true voice in Kansas. This is the Radio Free Kansas.
I'm your host, Mike Cadell, broadcasting from North Jefferson County, Kansas, smack dab between Kansas City, Topeka, Lawrence, Atchison. Easiest way to describe it. Put together quite a good show. Think you're gonna like it.
Radio Free Kansas on blogtalkradio.com/fightingcockfire.
Roseanne Cash for the American Association of Diabetes Educators.
Johnny Cash was my dad. For years, he had diabetes but ignored it, even as his vision and health slipped away. Diabetes is serious. It can steal your sight, your limbs, even take you away from the people who love you. But it doesn't have to be this way. If you have diabetes, test and control your blood sugar regularly. You'll be healthier and you'll feel better too. To learn more, visit healthywithdiabetes.org.
Hello, I'm Carol Gordon. Traditionally, Native women made all decisions regarding their reproductive health care. This was respected as women's business. Today, we are basically denied this decision-making power. It's time to take back that power making decisions concerning our reproductive health. There is a choice we can make regarding unwanted pregnancy. Plan B is an emergency contraceptive that must be taken within 72 hours after having unprotected sexual intercourse in order for it to be effective in preventing pregnancy. Contact your local Indian Health Service facility and ask if they carry Plan B. If not, tell them to order it. Plan B is an OTC, over-the-counter contraceptive, and a prescription is not necessary. You have a legal right to access this contraceptive over-the-counter. This message is brought to you by the Native American Women's Health Education Resource Center.
Voices Indigenous Radio brings to you the basics of how not to violate the law and presents the people who are fighting the war against Mother Earth. We bring the awareness of a different paradigm to the airwaves of WBAI as we shed the same old systematic paradigm that is killing Mother Earth. And you can hear the perspective of Indigenous peoples throughout the world and how they live with the law, land, air, and water. First Voices Indigenous Radio is produced in the studios of WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, streaming and archived on WBAI.org and First Voices Indigenous Radio.org.
Hey music lovers, this is Finian McKay and you're listening to a Creative Commons licensed podcast. Rock and roll forever.
This is Bruce LaBruce, www.brucelabruce.com, and you're listening to Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
Okay, welcome back to Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. We're on the line with Scott Campbell, otherwise known as the Angry White Kid, via Twitter, where, of course, you can find him at Angry White Kid, one word, on Twitter. His personal website is angrywhitekid.blogs.com.
And I advise you to go check it out and to hook up with his RSS feed in your favorite feed reader so that you don't miss a post. And we've been talking about the Zapatistas, at least that's how we brought it in. And then we tailed off into the American Native American struggle. Sorry, about the struggle for indigenous rights in North America. And what I want to get into now is the fact that the Zapatistas were the first indigenous group or first indigenous resistance organization that took the struggle to the internet. And they, and as far as I understand, there's still support groups around the world. Around the world. And, you know, that's an important thing because even though they do not define themselves as right or left, they were still able to make, if you can call it, respectful liaison with other political groups around the world. And that includes the African National Congress. I believe it also includes Sinn Féin in Ireland. You know, this is a major, 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 you know, piece of history that, as you know, we were talking earlier, is pretty much ignored. But what I want to get into now is the struggle in Palestine. Now, the PLO, if I understand correctly, had liaison at some degree, to some degree, at some point with the Zapatista national movement. And as an analyst, as an observer, you know, how do you articulate, or how do you look at these connections between groups like, say, the one of the governing bodies for the Palestinian resistance dealing with indigenous resistance in Mexico? I mean, how do you look at links like this and their relationship to the struggle?
I think that you see these links, especially occurring more and more frequently, as you pointed out, with the internet and the accessibility of communication. And as the Zapatistas were the first sort of indigenous group and really first guerrilla army to utilize the internet effectively, and to get out into what we called cyberspace back then, their message, and to find common support throughout the world due to that. We, of course, see that in Palestine because the Palestinians are an indigenous people struggling against colonization, ethnic cleansing, apartheid, and occupation. And there are so many overlapping issues between what the Zapatistas are facing and articulating and what the Palestinians are facing and articulating. And it's natural that these groups are going to find common cause, especially once it gets easier for them to talk to one another over great distances and through barriers such as language and culture. As far as the Palestine Liberation Organization, I am not too sure how much contact they've had with the Zapatistas. I know the Palestinian street and the Palestinian youth activists that I know well have, especially in recent years, become very vocal in their support for the Zapatista struggle, become vocal in the denunciation of paramilitary attacks in Chiapas, and the Zapatistas have acknowledged and received the support. There have been delegations, and there have been a development of mutual affinity, I feel, between Palestinian activists who not only see the Zapatistas an indigenous brother and sister who are struggling against the colonial system, but also admire their ways of articulating their desires and their means of going about and organizing for it. And I think both sides have a lot to teach one another, and that solidarity is really beautiful because you can see how it flows in both directions. And I think that's what we mean when we talk about solidarity and anti-colonial resistance.
Yeah, because, you know, when I say that, you know, contact, that's pretty much exactly what I mean. You know, we recognize your struggle. You recognize ours. We're both fighting colonialism. The Black Panther Party for Self-Defense had liaison with the PLO. The Black Party, the American Indian Movement at one point had liaison with the PLO and the IRA. You know, without going to those to those extents. But what I'm trying to get to is they became political, you know, and in many cases they formed alternative governments in exile. And the Zapatista model, I think, has a real impact on that. And when you hear about the Zapatistas as a inspiration in Africa, when you hear about the Zapatistas as an inspiration in mainland China, you know, I've seen stuff like this. You know, because people forget, you know, that the Han Chinese are not the only ethnic group in China. You know, you have, you know, multiple ethnic groups there. And they are still fighting for recognition. They're fighting just like the Zapatistas. We have the Wei people. We have the Uyghurs, you know, who are still the Tibetans. I mean, how can anyone forget that struggle? You have Mongolia that is still having problems along the border with China. When we see the model of resistance in terms of, you know, armed defense, nonviolent protest, the demand for negotiation, the willingness to compromise, and we see the unwillingness and the heavy-handed movements of governments that are coming after indigenous people who they know that they are violating their rights by their national laws and under international law. The Zapatistas as a model, how do you think non-governmental agencies like, say, the United Nations or maybe even Human Rights Watch, you know, where are they in terms of acknowledging, much less supporting, indigenous movements like the Zapatistas, who are acting in self-defense, who are not trying to take over the government, but simply trying to be independent and to be left alone?
Yeah, I think when it comes to international bodies or NGOs, non-governmental organizations such as Human Rights Watch or Amnesty, or we look at the United Nations, what I find is the flaw is that they operate by a very specific set of rules that they try to apply universally to situations that are not universal. And so we look at Human Rights Watch or Amnesty, and I don't believe they've said much about the Zapatistas in a long time. I could be mistaken. Maybe in their annual reports they come out with mentions of paramilitary attacks. But there is an acknowledgement of the fact that the Zapatistas do suffer harassment, attacks, and displacement as a result of the Mexican army and the federal government and state governments in Mexico arming paramilitary forces. But beyond that, there isn't much vocal support. In particular, this is because the Zapatistas, I feel, have really a lot of lessons to offer other indigenous groups and resistance groups in general around how to orient themselves towards state actors and non-state actors, in that the Zapatistas clearly define their upfront position is, we're going to say what goes and what does not go in our territory. We're not going to let you come in with your agenda and try to influence what happens here. We welcome your opinions, your feedback, but we're going to take what we like and leave the rest. And so groups, NGOs, usually don't like that. They usually like to come in and you know, do good, but also make a name for themselves. And so the Zapatistas could have so much more, in theory, materialistically, than what they do. But they've decided that the support that they were getting initially when they started opening up their territory to international human rights observers and to NGOs was that they were being flooded, and some places that were more popular, easily accessible, were getting more materials and support than other places, and it was becoming a stratified system, which was exactly what they were trying to oppose. And so they decided that they'd come up with these good governing councils that would determine what came in and in what form and where it would go overall throughout all of Zapatista territory. And as a result, because they're saying you have to play by our rules if you're going to work with us, a lot of groups decide that they don't want to work with them. And it really comes down to civil society again to step up and answer the call when the Zapatistas say, this happens, we need this from you. The people can say, we support you because we see in your struggle a struggle that we can identify with, and we're going to offer our support. That's where the solidarity really shows up, and it doesn't come through NGOs and organizations like the UN.
Are you aware of the current U.S. position on the Zapatistas?
I am not, actually. I believe since the fighting ceased in 1994, I know they're not labeled like a terrorist group or anything like that. I think they officially, in their annual human rights report, expressed concern around paramilitaries in Chiapas. But beyond that, I know they supply the Mexican government with a lot of military equipment and especially surveillance. As far as the Zapatistas go, they provide them with a lot of surveillance material to keep an eye on what is going on inside Zapatista territory. And they do encourage the Mexican government to resolve it in a way that is favorable to U.S. interests, obviously, which is not going to happen so long as the Zapatistas stay Zapatistas.
Yeah, because see, this leads into my next question. The war on drugs, Mexico is a part of this, and President Obama has made it, you know, very clear during his administration that they were going to do more to support Mexico and Central and South America in terms of the efforts against the trafficking of narcotics. Now, the Zapatistas are anti-narcotics. They've been having their own little wars against the various cartels in that region that have been trying to take over their area and to recruit or kidnap their people as labor. So, you know, that's one of the reasons why I asked you what the U.S. position would be, because almost every indigenous group that we can name, be they in Veracruz, Oaxaca, Chiapas, going further south, they're all anti-narcotics. When you get into First Nations communities, drug dealers, they're not welcomed. They're not welcomed at all. And they're usually forced to leave by the community. So when we see indigenous groups around the world that are fighting drug dealers just as much as the government in terms of the threat that they face, you know, why is the United States, which is doing what it's doing right now in Afghanistan, the support they're giving the Saudis in Yemen, we can talk about Iraq and you know, even the rise of the Islamic State in terms of the chaos now because of the initial invasions. Why isn't the United States stepping up more in terms of defending what the Zapatistas are trying to do in terms of keeping the drug trade out of their community?
I feel that the Zapatistas, you're right, are very clear. They have absolutely no drug, no alcohol policy in their territory. And this is in part due primarily because the ravages that alcohol abuse and alcoholism had in the communities, and in particular the impact it had on the women who, when the rebellion happened, came forward and said they were the ones who pushed for a ban on alcohol, and that was respected and implemented, and it's been in place for 21 years. And then they saw, especially once the so-called war on drugs started in the early 2000s, they saw the cartel activity increase and cartels trying to use their territory to traffic drugs and gain workers or kidnap people and extort people. And the Zapatistas are very clear that they've stopped trafficking going through their territory. They've confiscated drugs and destroyed drugs and detained people and dealt with them according to their own system of justice, which is usually hanging on to them, letting them know how the Zapatistas feel and then letting them go. But it's interesting, were the United States to offer support to the Zapatistas, I'm certain the Zapatistas would say no, but we also know that the United States isn't really interested in stopping the flow of drugs. I mean, it's a whole, the war on drugs is a way to make money, just like drugs is a way to make money. And what they're seeing is a $3.5 billion gift to the arms industry in the form of the Merida Initiative, or what's known as Plan Mexico, in this military aid that's gone to Mexico and countries in Central America, which really is manifested, as we've seen on the streets, in the U.S. further entrenching itself inside the defense and security forces in Mexico, the Mexican government selectively deciding how it's going to execute the war on drugs and which cartel is going to favor, which one is going to go against, and then more than anything else, how threats, the perceived threats such as the Zapatistas or indigenous resistance in Oaxaca or up in Baja California now with San Quintin, we see that the very tools that the U.S. government gave to Mexico to supposedly fight the war on drugs are being used to suppress social movements. And that's what it is. It's about entrenching a Mexican government that is pliant to the United States and will allow for further resource extraction and the further entrenchment of capitalism in Mexico. It has nothing to do with the war on drugs. It has everything to do with keeping a certain type of governance and certain type of system in place in Mexico. And it's now it's just taken the form of the war on drugs. Before that, it was concerns about migration. And before that, it was just straight up intervention and stealing half their country. So we can see this. The cycle just, again, capitalism adjusts itself to fit its current needs, and that's what I see happening with the war on drugs, but in particular in Mexico.
Yeah, it's because of, you know, the Reagan administration, Oliver North, and the Contras that I asked you that question. Because, you know, you would think, because of the rhetoric that this country, promotes out here, that they will be supporting the Zapatistas, who have a zero tolerance for drugs. And you look at Indonesia, you look at Malaysia, you look at Thailand, where, you know, you had the death penalty. How many foreign people were executed in Indonesia recently over drug trafficking? The United States was pretty quiet about it, other than to say that they had a right to run their affairs the way that they wanted to, the same way that they excused the beheadings in Saudi Arabia for adultery and sorcery and atheism and, you know, and what have you. That's the, you know, one of the things that I just really wanted to raise is the involvement of the U.S. How you mentioned the progression. First, it was direct intervention. We're talking about, I believe, four separate invasions of Mexico by the United States. We look at that history, and then we see, you know, through the Kennedy administration, the role of Mexico, and then the role that Mexico played during World War II. I mean, it was a battleground, Mexico City, even though it was neutral, for German spies, for British spies, American spies. I mean, there was a lot going on in Mexico. Trotsky died in Mexico. You know, I mean, he was, that's where he was assassinated. He was dealing with Frida Kahlo and her husband, Diego Garcia. You know, Mexico was not a minor country. You know, people in the United States, I really feel, have a very negative and low view of Mexico and have no real understanding of their history on this continent and their importance to the world, you know, through what? The oil trade? Through, you know, the money laundering and what have you. Mexico was not small. It's not a small matter. So you would think that the impact of the Zapatistas, the incredible impact they've made over two decades, would simply be acknowledged in the United States in terms of common knowledge that there is an indigenous movement in Mexico that is not paying attention. And I don't want to be redundant, but as a final question, you as an activist, somebody who was in the mix, how would you lay out maybe some kind of a guideline on how we can get the average person in the United States, in Canada, and in Mexico proper to be more conscious of the Zapatista movement, to be more knowledgeable, and to have more of a empathetic, you know, give a damn about what these people are struggling for and what we claim to be about in the democratic Anglophone West.
I think that what we can do is, first, those of us who are aware about the Zapatistas need to take some responsibility and, I think, pay more attention, at least be aware of what's going on. When they send out a communique, sometimes they're quite lengthy, sometimes recently they sent out probably 10 or 15 in the span of a few months, but to get a general gist of what's going on, because that resistance and that struggle is very real, it's very potent, it's very powerful, and it's still 21 to 31 years later, has a lot to teach us. I mean, they're still there, they're still strong, whether or not people are paying attention or not, they're going about their daily business of making a revolution in their own lives. And that is an immensely powerful example for anyone anywhere in the world. And I feel that we can amplify their voices, those of us who are aware of it. And then I think the next step is, when we find messages that resonate with people in the United States who can identify with, say, the Occupy movement that was going on in 2011, the very means of organizing that occurred within Occupy Wall Street and Occupy Oakland and so on, a lot of the rhetoric and the concerns are the same concerns and rhetoric and organizing methods that the Zapatistas have been practicing, advocating, or it was in the same spirit of Zapatismo.
I apologize, but I would like to interrupt you for a moment to mention something. When I say earlier that you know what's not happening in the United States, he mentioned Occupy, and it's important for me to note this. Occupy did step up. Occupy certainly did step up. Now, as an indigenous person, I had, you know, certain questions about the whole concept of Occupy and what have you. But, you know, when you really look at it, Occupy did step up. But a lot of people don't know this, and this is why I'm interrupting you. I would like people to visit whowhatwhy.com, Russ Baker's website. And you will find the redacted FBI files where it turns out that the Bureau knew that these activists were being targeted for assassination. They knew. They wouldn't name the entity, and obviously they were not prosecuted. But they knew that there were snipers that were being hired to go after the leaders of Occupy. But the problem was they couldn't find the leader of Occupy. They couldn't narrow it down to a personality or a handful of personalities. They didn't know exactly who to go after. And the Bureau found out about it and stopped it, but they didn't inform these people that they were under threat. Now, Russ Baker has the actual files for this, and if you Google or whatever search engine you like to use, go and look that up. They knew that these people were under threat and didn't do anything to defend them. And the last time I heard about anybody burning books was at the Occupy site. I believe it was in New York, on the actual Wall Street, the main site. They burned their books and destroyed their computers and their cameras. But they burned books. So, you know, I want to, you know, make it clear that I acknowledge that there are movements in the United States that are doing things. But we have to be really clear with ourselves that if we're not moving forward, then these things are not working and there has to be a change. And it doesn't mean we have to go to extremes, because I'm certainly not telling people out here to get armed. The Zapatistas did that because of what they're particularly dealing with. And then they made a decision to do that. And they were willing to deal with the ramifications for that. But Occupy was a nonviolent, totally peaceful movement. And they were being threatened by the higher-ups, by those that literally owned the country. And when law enforcement found out about it, they protected them by stopping the plot, but they didn't do anything to go after and acknowledge who these bastards were. So, you know, that when you mention the fact that the Zapatistas have influenced things like Occupy, that needs to be mentioned on why Occupy failed. Because you were talking about resistance before. You know, the resistance that Occupy got is exactly why Occupy quelled. It's not because that they were doing it wrong. The point was they were doing it right. And because, of course, we are not willing. When I say we, I'm talking about reasonable people, are not willing to go that extra goddamn mile. We don't fight back the way they do in other countries. And I'm not even advocating that it needs to get that far. But it's something that needs to be recognized when they talk about, influence. Scott Campbell is 100% correct. The Zapatistas, their entire format, when I read it, it could have been taken from a communique from the Zapatistas. And I'm sorry I interrupted you.
Oh, no problem. Thank you for that information. And it's Occupy was crushed very deliberately and very systemically. You know, from the federal government expressing concerns about the fact that the discussion in the media, we were having discussions about capitalism and if it was a good thing or not, and that's a discussion that can't be tolerated for very long in this country. And so I think that when we talk about the Zapatistas, and I keep going back to this, but I think it is a very potent message that they're calling for reframing of resistance based on a re-understanding and reanalysis of capitalism, and they call it the capitalist hydra. And with the very implicit mythology that the Hydra was eventually defeated based on these resistances that need to be articulated. And we talk about fighting back and what resistance looks like in place to place. And oftentimes it doesn't look the same. What we see in the rural mountains of southeastern Mexico in Chiapas is not what we see in Palestine, is not what we see in Papua New Guinea. And it's not what we see in Oakland, where right now the struggle is still going on against curfews and so on, and police violence. And I think what what the Zapatistas try to do is hold and encompass the multitudinous ways of resisting against a common enemy. And I think that's what we can learn, is that we need to use whatever tools are at our disposal and what's appropriate to the given situation, and to learn from lessons that happen in other places, and to craft our own site-specific resistance, but that's informed, that's thoughtful, and that really looks to benefit the broad spectrum of people in society and common humanity, which should be our goal, I feel.
Yeah, and as a real final question, common humanity. One of the reasons I supported the Zapatistas from day one was the fact that women were 100% part of the decision-making process, and they had an incredible influence on the development of the Zapatista party. And could you talk about Subcomandante Ramona, if you would?
Sure. Actually, she was, to clarify, she was a commander, a comandanta. It's right now, it's Galeano and Moises who were sub-commanders, and they take on that role explicitly to show that they're beneath the comandancia in speaking and sending out the communiques. Comandante Ramona was a powerful voice for the Zapatistas, and a powerful voice in particular for Zapatista women, who brought that narrative to the forefront, and in wearing that mask wore the experiences of indigenous women and Mexican women and women under capitalist society. And she articulated how the Zapatista women suffered under the colonial system, under capitalism, and under patriarchy. And then she articulated how, when the Zapatista revolution began, the women came forward and demanded an equal say and equal participation, and got things in place. There are women, specifically women mandated laws that are written into the Zapatista social structure. And she was the one who spoke before the Mexican Congress when the Zapatistas marched on Mexico City. She passed away a few years ago due to cancer, Marcos, Subcomandante Marcos, now named Galeano, wrote a beautiful homage to her. And it's interesting, during the seminar that just occurred earlier this month, there was an entire section dedicated to Zapatista women of all ages, from young to old, sharing their experiences of life as a Zapatista woman, both before 1994 and after 1994, including up until the present moment. And it's really powerful and potent stuff. I encourage people to check it out. You can go to enlacezapatista.ezln.org and read. There are about four or five women who spoke at the seminar about their experiences as Zapatista women, and it's powerful stuff.
Yeah, we couldn't end this without discussing Ramona and the other women who really made the Zapatistas a fully human force. I really feel that way. It's the same reason why I respected the American Indian Movement. I respected the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense, which in North America pretty much, you know, informed the American Indian Movement and many other organizations. Without the sisters, we don't have a movement. And the Zapatistas were very, very clear that, you know, women were, you know, not just partners. We are all together on this on the same level. And the communiques that I've read, and the transcriptions of speeches that she gave, I can't think of one that wasn't powerful. And she was certainly an inspiration to many people. And if there's, you know, one woman in Mexico that probably should be looked on as a modern example of what women can do in terms of, you know, standing up for their people and standing up for justice, Ramona has to be at the top of the list. Scott Campbell, thank you for your activism. Thank you for being a guest. And we really hope to hear more from you.
Absolutely. It was my pleasure. And thank you so much for your time and for having me on.
Okay. This is Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. We've been speaking to Scott Campbell, otherwise known as the Angry White Kid, on Twitter. And you can find him at Angry White Kid, one word, on Twitter. You can check what he's doing at angrywhitekid.blogs.com. He describes himself as an anarchist, a translator, and a blogger. As far as I'm concerned, from looking at the work that he does, he's a U.S. anti-colonialism and social justice activist, and I think he's someone that would be really worthwhile for you to follow
on the web so you can see what is happening in Mexico and further points south. I mean, he deals with everything that is going on in terms of anti-colonialism. And like other people out there who are doing that kind of work, we must support them. Get his RSS feed. Don't miss another post. This is Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. Please stay tuned.
I Don't Know More calls all people
to join in peaceful revolution,
to honor indigenous sovereignty,
and protect the land and water
for generations to come.
Mexicans, South Americans, all indigenous people, get inspired,
take action,
and become a part of the solution.
It's my future,
your future,
our future.
We are the protectors of Mother Earth.
Stand up and protect it.
Stand up and protect it.
Stand up
and protect our Earth.
Do not sit.
Do not sit.
Do not sit.
Do not sit.
And become a part of this incredible movement.
The time has come.
Idle no more.
Idle no more.
Idle no more. Become idle no more.
Hello, I am Susan Aglukkaq. The North has the highest incidence of sexually transmitted diseases, STDs, in the country. We also have a high rate of teenage pregnancies. High-risk behaviors, unprotected sex, lead to the spread of HIV/AIDS. It can be prevented. Learn the ways to protect yourself and others. Knowledge is power.
I'm Ron Reagan, an unabashed atheist, and I'm alarmed by the intrusions of religion into our secular government. That's why I'm asking you to join the Freedom From Religion Foundation, the nation's largest and most effective organization of atheists and agnostics, working to keep state and church separate. Phone 1-800-335-4021, 1-800-335-4021, or visit the Freedom From Religion Foundation at ffrf.org. Ron Reagan, lifelong atheist, not afraid of burning in hell.
This is FSNL reporter MJ Del Valle in Tbilisi, Georgia. Free Speech Radio News has been an essential outlet for my stories from the Caucasus region, including in-depth looks at the recent Armenian presidential election, the creative ways protesters in Azerbaijan are using to fight for freedom of expression, and labor struggles in the Republic of Georgia. But FSRN, along with the voices of people struggling for dignity, equality, and human rights, could be silenced. Find out how can you support independent grassroots journalists at fsrn.org.
You can't bring up, one guy sent me a very interesting thing about Barack Obama and race. You can't bring up anything other than that suddenly he's African-American. If you start to, you know, delve around the edges of, wait a minute, isn't he mixed race? Weren't we told that last year or whatever, biracial? Not allowed to say that anymore. Apparently, the mainstream media has dubbed him to be African-American.
Yeah, I was driving in today, and I was seeing, because I saw this piece with him on 60 Minutes, and I thought to myself, he's very white in many ways.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought to myself, gee, can I even say that? Can I even say that without somebody else starting a campaign saying, what does he mean he's very white? He is. He's very white.
When a Muslim without a birth certificate has taken over the White House, you need a good white former junkie to show you the direction that America needs to go in. Beck. It's What's for Demagogue.
This is The Horn. I'm Bob Kincaid. Head on RadioNetwork.com, an internet-based conversation radio experiment. Available most easily at HeadOnRadioNetwork.com. There's a Listen Live button. Just jump right on it, and there you are. Or if you're on a mobile device, it's also easy to find us at TuneIn Radio. A nice app for your mobile smartphone, or Tuner Internet Radio, or Dar.fm, or Stitcher Radio, Streama.com. We are rather ubiquitous. I mean, if we got more every night, we'd be paying salaries, right? Head on RadioNetwork.com.
Now that America has a black president, is this proof that racism is a thing of the past?
Well, I think white men were 100% of the people that wrote the Constitution, 100% of the people who signed the Declaration of Independence, 100% of the people who died at Gettysburg and Vicksburg, probably close to 100% of the people who died at Normandy. This has been a country built basically by white folks in this country who were 90% of the entire nation. I think they ought to do. They ought to defend the legitimate rights of white working class folks who are the victims of discrimination.
With white people showing love like this, who needs enemies? Intelligent Aboriginal Media. The anti-colonial cure for mental slavery.
You are listening to the Angry Indian on Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
Triomphante allégresse, ses jolies lançants y chantent.